and diligently. You just mean the world to me because you are my family and I appreciate you. But I want to just say to those of you that are visiting how much you mean to me personally. I always think about that when somebody visits us, sometimes you're from far away, like you're from out of town and you've traveled to be here for whatever reason, work or vacation. I don't know why you'd come here this time of year for vacation. But you're here. And what I really love about you visiting with us is that you believe something that means a lot to me. And what you believe is that even though you're away from home, you're never away from God. And you make it a priority wherever you're at to make sure you celebrate Him on the day that He asked. And you get together with people that have like faith. And that just means a lot to me that you're here. Maybe you're not from out of town. Maybe you're from nearby, from the neighborhood. But I do want to say you're equally as encouraging to me. It's not easy to walk into a strange place where you don't know people and sit down in an unfamiliar environment and try to learn what's going on in that place. Fact of the matter is you may never have been in a church quite like ours who does things the way we do things or doesn't do things the way a lot of people do nowadays. But it really does mean a lot that you love God enough or have some need in your life that makes you seek out things. I just want you to know that we share that same concern. We want to know what's right. We want to help each other. We want to get to know you, and we have nothing to hide here. So thanks for being with us. My yearly theme this year is love. Without love, I am nothing, from 1 Corinthians 13. I said at the beginning of this series last month, the first lesson I did, I don't know that there's any more worthwhile thing for us to talk about this year. Love is lacking these days, from the top down, from those that should be leaders. Some aren't exhibiting love in the ways that God would have them, to those that are not leaders, just everyday citizens of our country. Many unloving things are being done and said. God wanted to create a kingdom, a community, and a family where love existed, where love reigned, where love was real. The influences of the place we live and the time that we live, I think, is a challenge to Christians. And I want this year for us to get a hold of what love really looks like and work on it and practice it and be the examples of it in the world around us. In a moment, I'm going to read this section of Scripture and make some observations, and then we'll get into our specific lesson for today. I forgot to put this up. There's what we're going to do throughout the year, breaking this text up and looking at it closely. Let me show you some things about, though, the context of this in the letter to the Corinthians. The letter that Paul wrote to this group of people was actually a part of correspondence that he was having with them. Go back to chapter 1, and let me show you a little bit of the structure of this book. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 11 says, "For I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you." The first couple of chapters of this book, Paul's writing based upon a report that he's heard. Whoever Chloe was and whoever her people were, or his people, whoever Chloe was, there was a report given to Paul, and they said, "Hey, that church back in Corinth, they're a wreck, they're a mess, there's divisions, they're fighting, they're arguing." So for the first couple chapters, everything that Paul is writing is based on that verse, that he had heard a report about them. Now look at chapter 5, verse 1. Chapter 5, verse 1. Chapter 5, verse 1 says, "It is actually reported that there is immorality among you, an immorality of such a kind as does not exist among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife." Now, for the next little bit, Paul's going to write about that, that he'd heard that in this church somebody was with their stepmom, or whatever it was, and doing things that ought not have been done among Christians, and he even says typically wasn't even done among people who weren't Christians. So the next part of the letter deals a little bit about what he'd heard in that report. Now look at chapter 7, verse 1. here is a shift in the book, the structure of the book. 7:1 says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote," and then he goes on to say some things. What we can assume is that Paul had been with the Corinthians before. Not only have they discussed things, but Paul now writes this letter based on things he's heard and things that they wrote him about. Now, we don't have that letter. I don't know what it sounded like, but evidently they wrote him and they had some questions. And they're like, "Hey, Paul, what's this business about marriage? Is it okay for us to sleep with anybody like we have done in Corinth for all these years because of the temple of Aphrodite there and all the things that were going on in that city?" They had some questions, and so Paul begins to respond to their questions. And as this book goes on, that's what's going on. They've had questions that he's answering. Look at chapter 12 now. Chapter 12, verse 1. Paul says, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware." Now, I'm going to suggest that this was a topic, and this is going to be the topic in chapter 12, 13, and 14, that they had questions about. They were wondering about the spiritual gifts that God had been giving them. It's kind of a foreign concept for us to think about what the first century church would have looked like, where God was miraculously empowering people to communicate for him. They didn't have a Bible yet. They didn't have the scriptures. They hadn't collected letters from all the apostles. God had a plan. We're going to find out in chapter 13 that eventually some of these spiritual gifts would cease. But the way the church operated was people were supernaturally empowered to preach messages in a different language and prophetically and say things from God. It would have been kind of a confusing thing for us. It's confusing for them. They didn't understand it all. They were asking questions about it. And they were fighting about it. Because some people had spiritual gifts that other people thought were better than others. You know, they liked what some people could do, and they weren't so enamored with their own spiritual gift. And so they were arguing about that. Now, what we're about to read in chapter 13 is Paul's explanation as to how they're going to get this figured out. But it's more than that. Chapter 13 is more than just, "Hey, you Corinthians that are arguing about spiritual gifts, you got to figure out this love thing so that you can get along." What Paul is actually teaching in chapter 13 is, this is the thing God's trying to accomplish among you. He wants you to be loving toward each other because that period of spiritual gifts was going to cease, and what the church was going to be left with was whether or not they loved each other. And once the time came where God would stop talking to them in miraculous ways, which we're going to find out in chapter 13 as we read it, was for the church's infancy. It was actually an immature part of the church's history. But when they would grow up and that would be done away with, love was what was going to exist, and it had to be real. So I want you to think about that as we read chapter 13. Just before we read, notice the last thing said in chapter 12. "Earnestly desire the greater gifts, and I show you still a more excellent way." Last month, our sermon was, "Love is excellent." That was from that verse. It's a more excellent way than all kinds of other things. And it's also greater. That's going to be the last verse of chapter 13. But let's read, starting in verse 1. "If I speak with the tongue of men, the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant. Does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things, love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, think like a child, reason like a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, and then I will know, but then I will know fully, just as I also have been fully known. But now faith, hope, love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. There are many great teachings in this text. Of course, the focus of the text is on showing what love looks like, defining love. Love is hard to define, even biblically. I could say, hey, I want to tell you all the Greek words for love. This word is agape, and I want to tell you what it means. But I've always liked the quote from the movie Forrest Gump. When his mom was trying to teach him what stupid meant, and he said stupid, she said stupid is as stupid does. Stupid's a hard word to define. But I'll tell you how to define it is watch what it does. And that's how you know what it is. Love is similar. We could try to come up with all the great ways to describe agape love. But I'll tell you what love is as love does. And if you want to know what love is, this is the list to go to. I'll say more in a different lesson sometime about the second half of this chapter, about love never failing, even though the gifts would fail, and there was a time coming where the church would put away its childish things and would operate in maturity. We'll do that sometime. It's not part of this series, but I'll try to get to that this year since it's part of our text. Today, I want to talk about this this idea that without love I am nothing. This is the title track for the album, the title lesson for this series. I want you to look at verses 1, 2, and 3 with me, and I want to break them down a little bit. I think these verses are powerful and challenging. Notice the structure of this text. Verse 1 says, if I speak. Verse 2 says, if I have. Verse 3 says, if I give. I want you to look at those three things for a minute. If I speak, if I have, and if I give. By the way, life is sort of defined by these things. We are what we talk about. Our influence in the world has to do with not only what we speak, but how we speak and whether or not we're very good at it. Life also has to do with what we have. I have abilities, I have possessions, I have education, I have a lot of things. How does this define me as a person? And life has to do with what we give, like what we then extend to others because of what we have as resources. The structure of this text is this. If I speak, if I have, and if I give, and then the next thing that's said is, I am something because of this. Think about how people define themselves, how you define yourself. Who are you? Who are you? The way that you would usually describe who you are has to do with what you speak, what you have, and what you give. I am this person because of these particular things in my life. I am something. I like to think of myself as something. But I want us to go through the text, and I'll save some parts of it till the end, and just get you to think about the power of what Paul's saying in this text. Let's start with the first thing. What does he say about speaking in verse 1? He says, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels. Just look at that. If I speak with the tongue of men and of angels. Your version, if you have the Holman Christian Standard Version, it reads like this. If I speak human or angelic languages. I really like that translation because when we use the word tongues, sometimes we don't understand what the Bible means. The Bible very simply means, when it says tongues, it means languages. When people in the first century spoke in tongues, they spoke in languages. First and foremost, what they spoke in were human languages. Languages they had never learned. Languages they had never studied. If they were Hebrew-speaking people, they might miraculously be able to speak Egyptian. Or they might be able to miraculously speak something that they'd never studied. and they could communicate in human languages. It was supernatural. You know why this is important today? How many of you either grew up in, or were around, or have family members that are part of churches that practice what we call tongue speaking? How many of you have been around that? All right, I'm going to ask you a real serious question. How many of you that grew up in that environment have known people that, quote, spoke in tongues that could miraculously speak in an actual human language that they'd never studied? Anybody know anybody like that? It doesn't happen. And I want you to know this. It did in the first century. Acts chapter 2 talks about these people speaking in actual human languages because they had the Holy Spirit and people could understand them in their own language. That doesn't happen today. And I'm going to suggest to you it's because what's happening today in most churches isn't biblical and it's not what this text is talking about. It's a phenomenon that goes on among sort of charismatic groups of people because they want to do this, but it's not actually from God. The first thing they could do is they could speak human languages. Now, what they'll typically tell you, your tongue-speaking friends, is, yeah, it may not be a human language, but it is an angelic language. They'll make that claim that what they're speaking in their, what sounds like gibberish, is an angelic language. And they'll use this verse to say it. If I speak with the tongue of men and of angels. I'm really careful about what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. It is awfully presumptuous for anybody to say that the language that's coming out of their mouth is actually a heavenly or angelic language, unless they're sure that it really is. Folks, I've had tongue-speaking friends who grew up tongue-speaking, and they've told me, many of them that put it away, that the language that was coming out of their mouth was just something they were doing. It was something that was coming out of their mouth, because that was what they chose to say. If you're going to claim it's angelic or from God, you better be sure that it is. Now, I don't want to get into a big discussion about this before the lesson that I'll do on this someday. But I want to ask you this. If I could stand before you today, and if I had the power to speak human languages that I'd never studied, if I could have gone to India last month, and gone there and spoke Telugu and Tamil and all the things, Hindu. And I could have just showed up and without having ever studied, God empowered me to communicate with the Indian people. Do you think that would be amazing? Do you think that would be awesome? And if I could speak languages that were angelic, I mean, like, I know what they're saying in heaven right now. Have you ever thought about this? When we all die and go to heaven, hopefully we'll all be able to communicate. You know, Tower of Babel stuff will be reversed. We're going to speak English, right? Hey, that's what we're going to speak? Anybody know? Anybody know what we're going to be talking up there? I don't know. But if I knew what they're saying in heaven, would you be impressed? And I could speak their language. So, if I could speak with human or angelic languages, typically here's what I'd say. I am an amazing and gifted communicator. I'm not like anybody else. You won't meet people like me because I can go anywhere in the world and talk to them in their language and I even know what they're saying in the spiritual realm. That's amazing. And I am gifted as a communicator. Let's talk about verse 2. Verse 2 says, "And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith, so as to remove mountains." I want you to think about that for a moment. What if I had all understanding and all knowledge and all faith? What if that was real? this is probably a dangerous thing to say, but I want you to think about this church and everybody you know in the church, and without saying it out loud, who's the smartest person you know here? Biblically, like, who has the most knowledge and wisdom and understanding about the Word of God in the room? You got them? What do you think of them? The one who, through all their life, has dedicated themselves to knowing the Word of God. And they've got it down. I mean, maybe they themselves admit they don't know everything, but they've got the most in the room. How about this? Let's up the ante and say, let's say that person knew it all. One of the spiritual gifts, evidently, was that they didn't necessarily have to go and look in the scripture to remember where it was. God would just give it to them and they knew where it was. Like, they just had understanding and knowledge. And they could prophesy. They could, like, look at your life and say, hey, do you know what's going to happen to you? What if somebody was in the room like that? That not only do they have all knowledge and all understanding and all faith to move mountains, but they could, like, prophesy about people and be like, you're going to get that job, or you're going to lose your job, you better start looking, or you're going to do this and you're going to do that, and they could prophesy. What would you think of them? Well, here's what I would say. If I had those things, I am a perfectly wise counselor and an amazing teacher. You agree? Let's talk about verse 3. Verse 3 says, and if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned. I want you to think about the significance of this. Has anybody ever known anybody, any person, who actually did this? They gave up all their goods, all their possessions, and gave the money to the poor, or they gave it all away to poor people. Has anybody ever known anybody like that? Nobody? I met a guy, preacher. He's been single all his life. He's older now. He's a bachelor. He's always been a bachelor. And now that he's getting older, he told me recently that he's downsizing. You know, he had a house and he had stuff and he's getting older and doesn't have family. So he said what he's doing is he's just giving it all away. Like, he's giving stuff away, giving it all out, like downsizing everything. You know, sort of getting rid of a lot of the money that he had held because he doesn't think he's going to need it, and he's just giving it to the poor. Can I tell you what I think of that guy? I think he's cool. I like him. I think that more people should be like him. He's a really good man for doing that. But I've never known anybody that gave everything. But what if you did know them? What about if they were somebody who gave their body to be burned? Has anybody ever personally known a martyr? You ever known somebody that died for Jesus? Let me ask it this way. Have any of you guys seen any of the videos online or on the news about Christians who are being beheaded or put in cages and lowered or burned? Has anybody seen that? I've seen it. Anybody else? You seen it? What do you think of them? First of all, do you think about them? But what do you think about them? I think they're heroes. I think they're amazing. I think that I don't know that I could be them. So I want you to think of the force of this. If you knew somebody who was this benevolent and this willing to give their life, you know what they are? They are a hero and an inspiration. Do you agree? All right, so now I want us to turn this all on its head. Because that's actually not what Paul says about these people. He makes a list of all the greatest things he can think of. And where we might respond with, they are something. They are amazing. They are all of these things. Here is the other part of the equation. The verses all say something like this, but I do not have love. Now, look at verse 1, 2, and 3, and let's list what Paul says these people actually are. Number 1, in verse 1, if I speak with the tongue of men and of angels but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. I am not a gifted and amazing communicator. I am noise. That's all I am. Is that overstating it? Is it? That doesn't seem fair. It seems fair to look at the gifts the person has and say, you know what? Even if they don't have something maybe internally right, they're at least still an amazing communicator. Paul says they're just cymbals and gongs. I really wanted to get some of those today. Would you have enjoyed that? Like, I wanted to get them, and while I was teaching, I just wanted to, like, clamor them while you're trying to pay attention so that you could get the illustration of that. Verse 2. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. I am not a perfectly wise counselor. I am not a gifted teacher. I am nothing. Is that overstating it? I mean, isn't the person that knows all that stuff and understands it and can apply their faith in a way that removes mountains and can tell people what the future is about God's things, aren't they something? Paul says they're nothing. Verse 3. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, I gain nothing. It profits me nothing. All right. I don't think I have to do a lot of preaching about how powerful this text is, do I? It's an amazing thing to think, an amazing thing to say, that you could put somebody before this congregation that had all the things that are described, but if they were lacking this one characteristic of love, they go from being the greatest people in the world to noisy, nothing, and unproductive. That's an amazing thing to say. I just want to make a few observations about those three statements. I am noise, I am nothing, and I gain nothing. First thing I want you to notice is how often Paul uses the word I in the text. Did you see that? If I am nothing. I am noisy. I am this. And I want to make this very clear. This whole talk about love and the value of people and who we can decide is noisy, nothing, or profiting nothing is not about us using any other pronoun than I. God didn't teach us this so that I could say you, or he, or she, or them, or the president, or a politician. They're all lacking love, and they're nothing. Paul is good about saying, let's put me into the equation and talk about me. By the way, it would actually be quite dangerous for you to say this about anybody else, wouldn't it? Is anybody here confident enough to say about another human being out there in the world that they are nothing? Anybody want to volunteer to say that? Who do you believe out there is nothing? Do you believe there's anybody like that out there? We don't get to talk like that about people. But Paul could say that about himself. I'll try to make sense of that in a minute. I want to talk about this idea, though, about not just the I of this, but look at the first one, I am noise. What does it mean that somebody could be just noise and not, even though they were gifted with language and communication, what does it mean they could just be noise? You guys have heard this phrase before. People don't care how much you know until they what? Know you care. People don't care how much you know until they know you care. God said that first, right here in verse 1. That somebody could speak language and communicate with all kinds of people, and to the listeners, they become nothing more than noise that they don't want to listen to anymore because they don't operate within love. Have you ever known that person, by the way? Have you? You ever had a professor who was absolutely brilliant off the charts and knew things about everything, and you were like enamored with it, until you listen to him for like a few weeks and you realize that he had like a dark black heart and he didn't love you or anybody else, and it didn't matter anymore what he knew. It didn't matter anymore what he communicated. You just wanted to get out of his class. You ever known that person? There's a danger of this in the church. In chapter 14, Paul's going to use another illustration like this about their spiritual gifts. Look at verse 6. But my brethren, if I come to you speaking in tongues, what will it profit you unless I speak to you either by way of revelation or of knowledge or of prophecy or of teaching? Yet even lifeless things, either flute or harp and producing a sound, if they do not produce a distinction in the tones, how will it be known what is played on the flute or the harp? For if the bugle produces an indistinct sound, who will prepare himself for battle? So also you, unless you utter by the tongue speech that is clear, how will it be known what is spoken? For you will be speaking into the air. There are perhaps a great many kinds of languages in the world, and no kind is without meaning. If then I do not know the meaning of the language, I will be to the one who speaks a barbarian, and one who speaks will be a barbarian to me. So also you, since you are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek to abound for the edification of the church. Okay, here's the illustration. Paul says, instruments make noise. How many of you have had kids that learn to play an instrument? You ever had kids that learn to play an instrument? I don't want to embarrass anybody, and I see the look on your face right there. But when they first started to play the instrument, you were like, oh, it's so cute that they're doing that. But as time went on, they better have figured out distinction in tones, right? Like, they had better figured out how to make sense of that instrument. Because if all they kept doing was squeaking and snorting and like doing all that stuff that they did at first, you'd lose your mind. Because the whole point of an instrument is to make sure that it's clear so that the person understands the song. Or if the guy gets out on the battlefield and tries to blow the bugle, you know, I don't know what that tune is for people to charge, do-do-do-do-do-do, right? And if they get up and they squeak something out and all the soldiers look at each other because it doesn't make any sense, you didn't do anything at all. You know what the key to this text is? Look at what we read there at chapter 14, verse 12. Seek to abound for the edification of the church. You know what love is? Love is not knowing things. Love is not even speaking things. Love is knowing and speaking things in such a way that you build people up. And I'll tell you what this text teaches is you can't do that unless you actually love people. David and I, when we went to India, we were talking on the plane on the way, and we both said the same thing. We both said, you know what? We're nervous about communicating with them. I don't know if we're going to make sense. I don't know if it's going to work through translation. I don't know if what I say is going to be helpful to them. But you know what David said? David said, but if we love them, it's going to work. I think that's right. You'll figure it out. And people will probably pay attention because you care about them. Look at the second phrase. I am nothing. I'm nothing. Is that even biblical to say? I want to ask you that. Is it biblical to say that any human being is nothing? The Bible doesn't teach that. In fact, Paul didn't believe that either. Paul believed this. Look at Romans 14. Romans chapter 14. In Romans 14, Paul is talking to a church that's having trouble loving each other. Some of them are insisting on their rights to eat certain foods and drink certain drinks and keep certain days, when it's difficult for the other person because it causes them to stumble. And Paul keeps telling them, you guys need to figure this out and learn how to love each other. Paul gives us a hint, though, as to how he thought of people. Look at verse 15. For if because of food your brother is hurt, you are no longer walking worthy according to love. Do not destroy with your food him for whom Christ died. You see that phrase? When Paul looked at other people, he never once thought, they are nothing. What he thought was, they're valuable because Jesus died for them. Skip down a couple verses to verse 20. Here's the other attitude he had. Do not tear down the work of God for the sake of food. Two things Paul believed about people. Number one, they had value because Jesus died for them. And number two, they were the work of God. So let me ask you again. Is it okay to say about anybody that they're nothing? No. So how could Paul say, I am nothing? I think the answer to it is this. What Paul understood about being the work of God, made in the image of God, and somebody for whom Christ died, what that meant was that we were supposed to be people who would live in the image of God, that would come up from the death that we once were and be renewed in the image of the one who created us. Now, Paul's speaking in this context. So what if I, as a Christian, do all these amazing things at the top of the list, but I do not learn love? God is love, but I am not. I think this is when Paul would say, I am nothing, really. Everything God made me to be, I was meant to be like Him. I was meant to love, and I'm not. And only in this way am I now nothing. Look at the third phrase. I gain nothing. And maybe the focus of this has to be on the I. By the way, if somebody gives all their goods to feed the poor, does somebody gain something? Yeah, the poor gain something. They get a meal or whatever they end up with. If somebody's martyred, does anybody gain something? How many of you, by the way, have been encouraged by seeing people martyred for their faith? Encouraged by their faith, not encouraged by the hostility, not encouraged by the murder. But has anybody been inspired when somebody has given their body to the burning stake? Has anybody been encouraged by what they've done? Have you gained from their sacrifice? I have. But listen to what he says. If I don't have love, I gain nothing. And I can't assume that what this means is, God, as long as I've done it for somebody else, then surely you're going to make me gain from it. Because God says, no, you know what? You can do those things for a lot of other reasons than love. If you want to gain from it, you have to learn to love. Jesus talked like that. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, many will come to me on that day and say, Lord, Lord, didn't we do this in your name? And didn't we do this in your name? And didn't we do this in your name? These people would do all these things, but Jesus would respond, I never knew you. Depart from me. You practice lawlessness. What law? I did practice the law that said tithe, mint, anise, and cumin. I did practice the law that said go to church and read my Bible. I was a Pharisee who did all these things. And Jesus said, these things you should have done without neglecting the others. You've neglected mercy. And justice. And love. I gain nothing. So, is this lesson encouraging to you? It's challenging, isn't it? Anytime people talk about love, they want it to be like, hey, let's talk about love. Love is great. Love is good. I'll tell you what, folks. Love is the most elusive and difficult and painful thing to ever accomplish. In fact, I'd suggest to you that it'd be easier to give away all your possessions to the poor than to learn to love. But it won't do you any good unless you pursue love. I hope you'll join us this year in this discussion. Next month we'll talk about love being patient, which is a great lesson because you're going to hear about this all year, so you got to be patient. We're going to offer an invitation. And the invitation is simply this. God loves you. He doesn't believe you are nothing. He knows that you've fallen short of His glory, but He wants you to be better. He's willing to forgive you in Jesus Christ and renew you to His image. You can become something, even though you're dead in sin. But let's not come short of what God called us to by forfeiting all of that. If you're a Christian who doesn't love like you should, make it right today. If you want to become a Christian today, we offer you that opportunity while we stand and sing together.